Welcome to Deft Decisions in Chaotic Conditions, How Experts Create Order from Turmoil, the thought-provoking series on how to set, align, and implement priorities. Here's the host of our show, management consultant, speaker, educator, and president of Business Alignment Strategies, Pat Lynch.
Welcome. I am Pat Lynch. With me today is Dr. Michael Suskind. Dr. Suskind has been practicing clinical psychology in San Diego. His interests include child, adolescence, and adult counseling. In addition, he performs a variety of psychological evaluations. His most recent interest is in psychological pharmacology, and I will let him explain that in just a moment. So welcome, Michael.
Thank you, Dr. Lynch. Glad to be with you this morning. And maybe a good place to begin is some explanation of what role psychologists are assuming in the world of psychopharmacology. This is a new application of psychologists' unique skills, and specifically what happened in the world of psychology is that psychologists are now able to get additional training and education in various aspects of physiology and medicine. And with that training and the appropriate completion of certain national examinations and applications, psychologists are beginning to prescribe medication. And what sets apart psychologists perhaps from other health practitioners, particularly psychiatrists and general physicians, is that our training in pharmacology is designed to help us integrate the use of medicine into a much more patient-oriented approach to the use of medicines within the context of counseling. I'm very excited about this opportunity, and I actually think it bears on our discussion today about achieving priorities and setting goals, because there are a number of areas or a number of reasons that might be considered to be more medical that prevent people at times or interfere with people setting priorities and achieving goals. And at times, the use of medication is quite useful in addressing those issues. And some of the most common and probably well-recognized areas of challenge that would be described perhaps as physiological or biological include attention deficit disorder, anxiety disorders of various kinds, depressive disorders, and such. So those are more extreme situations, and I'm not trying to suggest that a standard treatment or a standard approach to helping people achieve priorities is the use of medication, but there are times when psychological or medical symptoms are one of the root causes of difficulty in setting goals and achieving priorities.
So, yeah, I think that's a very important point. And even though you're not going to prescribe here, you're not, advocating that for everyone, I do believe it's very important for people to believe that in some cases there are psychological and or biological causes that may prevent people from achieving the priorities that they set or in setting them in general. And so I think that is important and maybe a relief to some people to hear that. At the same time, we don't want it turning into an excuse.
That's right. And I think medication in all cases, has to be used judiciously. And certainly in my future practice as a psychopharmacologist, I'm going to look at the patient or the client, the individual I'm working with, as a whole person and use medication when that's appropriate, but mm-hmm. use it also as part of a broader package of strategies when people are not able to achieve their goals or priorities. And in some ways, I think one can look at counseling or therapy. Most people come to counseling or therapy in a sense because there is some area of their life which we could broadly call an area that involves a goal or goals and priorities that are not being achieved, that there's been some kind of a breakdown in the ability of an individual to move toward a goal or a priority. Not always, but surprisingly, in many cases, people come to a therapist or a counselor and are distressed or disturbed about their inability to achieve a goal that is important to them. And if we define goal in a broader way to include relationships, academic or educational goals, the ability to, engage in certain kinds of activities in their life, which can include physical activities that they may be afraid to embrace, or educational goals which they do not feel capable of achieving. If we use goal, the word goal and the notion of goal in the broadest possible way, then I think there are lots of life endeavors that fall under that umbrella.
Right, right. And I think that defining goal in that very broad sense and including priorities in that goal is very appropriate. And before we go on, I just want to clarify, you are not a new, clinical psychologist. You've been practicing quite a long time.
I have. I've been in practice for about 30 years, first in New York, and for the last 28 years, I've been licensed in California. So, yes, I've been at this for a while.
Okay. I just wanted to clarify because we were talking about your most recent interest in psychopharmacology, but I just want to make sure people know you're not a novice. In fact, you're very experienced in this area, and that's one of the reasons that I was so pleased that you accepted my invitation to talk to me about setting priorities. So I think you've talked about and you've really brought up some an interesting perspective in terms of obstacles that prevent people from setting priorities. So my question is, what might you suggest to help people either overcome or perhaps minimize those obstacles?
Right. Well, that's an important question, and it's one that I face every day in my clinical practice. Because, as I said, many people come to counseling or therapy because they're stymied or stuck or they've reached an impasse of some kind. So frequently what I'm doing is helping people to develop a plan, an action plan, if you will, to achieve a particular goal. And some of the strategies that psychologists use, particularly in this day and age, fall under the umbrella of what we call cognitive behavioral therapy, which is one of the most widely researched and documented forms of therapy, and it's a form of therapy that involves looking at the emotional assumptions and thoughts, often erroneous thoughts and less than rational thoughts that we have, that we entertain, that we bring into our daily activities. And these thoughts and feelings often interfere with our ability to move forward. For example, I have a number of people in the practice who I'm working with using cognitive behavioral therapy, and a typical situation, I'll just make something up, but this broadly represents, I think, a somewhat typical situation is someone who presents with a fear of one kind or another. And I'm working with a number of people who, younger people who are concerned about their ability to graduate from college. And they have perhaps an array of ideas about themselves that are interfering with their ability to successfully achieve in the academic arena. And those assumptions or those fears often include negative thoughts about their competence, their intelligence, their articulateness, their ability to organize themselves in the face of certain kinds of academic challenges, papers and, talks and that kind of thing. So often, using the cognitive behavioral therapeutic approach, what you're doing is you're beginning by asking people to explore the internal chatter or the internal talk that's going on. And, more specifically, what I often do is ask an individual to a little bit of a diary or a log about how they're thinking about themselves, particularly when they're approaching a task, let's say a term paper or the preparation for an examination. And over time, and actually a relatively short period of time, it's possible to look at those internal thoughts or perceptions and recognize certain negative aspects of that internal dialogue that is directly bearing on the individual's inability to complete a task. For example, frequently somebody who has low self-esteem may be saying to themselves as they approach a paper or an assignment, "I can't possibly do this. This is much too hard. I don't have the intelligence or the ability to do this particular assignment." And that kind of dialogue is extremely damaging. And if one begins to look at that and address it, it's possible to change the nature of that dialogue. And by doing that, help the individual to move forward with whatever it is that they need to achieve. And that is, in short, the essence of this practical approach
right.
to resolving the inability of somebody to set a priority or achieve a goal. And that is the essence, to some degree, of what I'm calling cognitive behavioral therapy, looking at and modifying one's views, thoughts, feelings, and perceptions.
Mm-hmm. Now, is there a way for, say, in a work situation where you have individuals who are in the same type of situation as the students you just described in general? You know, they doubt their abilities. They don't think they have enough intelligence, or they're inarticulate, or whatever it may be. We find the same things in the workplace.
Yes.
How can, say, a manager, or how can managers help their employees get past those kinds of internal chatter and, point out to them that, that what they're thinking, that the attributions they're really making about their own abilities may not be real? Is there a way that in addition to, or maybe on the way to seeking professional counseling, that especially these days when people are there's so many fears, there's so much anxiety, there's so many concerns, what can be done using this cognitive behavioral therapy as a kind of background? What can a layperson do?
Yes, that's a very good question. And I think there is definitely carryover, that the notion of cognitive behavioral therapy, while managers are not counselors and therapists, mm-hmm. they are functioning in what I would consider to be more of a sort of a coaching, more in a, as a coach or utilizing the coaching model. They are encouraging their employees or their supervisees to move forward with certain goals and priorities. And while the manager or the supervisor may not be involved in a dialogue with the person that they're supervising in the way that I'm involved with a patient or a client, what they can do that represents a very similar kind of activity is to ask the individual to do their own personal inventory and to look at the messages that they are sending to themselves and take stock of that and inventory those inner voices, those dialogues, and try to modify them. And I also think it's appropriate for managers and supervisors, if there is a psychological blockage or what appears to be a psychological blockage, to use external psychological resources, if that seems appropriate, in certain cases, and recommend that people perhaps look to other sources of support.
Mm-hmm.
But getting back to the work environment, in addition to asking people to inventory their own inner dialogue, some of the other things that seem to be important are the recommendation that an individual, an employee, look at their goals, write them, make sure that they are in line with what's being asked of them, that they are realistic, that they are measurable, that there is a way for them to see progress and to experience a sense of momentum. The other thing that seems terribly important that I think has application in the work setting is to make sure that there is enough external support, that individual employees have access, sufficient access to a supervisor or a manager if they have questions or if they're stymied, so that there is some ongoing dialogue.
Okay. And I do think that's important. I was doing a workshop the other day on setting priorities, and, you know, I said to people, because in our U.S. business culture, we do not handle emotions well, or people who are emotional. I think that's going to have to go by the boards, and we're going to have to start dealing with the fact that people need to be able to go to someone and say, you know, I'm concerned about this, or express their anxiety, or to vent in ways that most people, in my experience, are not comfortable doing. Do you think that that's, I don't know, that's my opinion. That's my unprofessional, opinion, that managers are going to have to do more of this in terms of dealing with people's emotions. Does that sound reasonable?
It does sound reasonable. I think one always has to look at the cultural situation. And as the notion of, for lack of a better way to put it, psychology permeates the culture, and people become more sophisticated about feelings and about their impact on the quality of life and on, how people move forward in their lives. I think that perspective will and does find its way into every area of culture, including the workplace. And so if we as a culture are more and more capable and able and aware of emotion and its role in daily life, then we need to be able to translate that language or that mode of discussion or that perspective into the workplace as well. And I think that's happening to some degree. For example, the use of various kinds of screening instruments in corporate settings, the way psychological screening instruments have found their way into the work corporate setting, I think is a reflection of the role that psychological notions and strategies have in the corporate world.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think it's a great leap for the language of psychology to be incorporated into the manager's role with individual supervisees going forward.
Right, right. And I think it's important to point out also that, you know, managers are not and should not be counselors in the professional sense of the word. And, you know, should they run into situations in which they believe people need professional help, that they do need to refer them elsewhere.
Yes, I think that that managers are, in a sense, somewhat like first responders. I mean, they are on the front line. They are working with people. They are interacting with people. And it's inevitable that in their interactions with their supervisees and workers that they're going to encounter people who are distressed, who are having difficulties, and they need to know how to manage those situations and to make appropriate referrals.
Mm-hmm. So how would you, going along with this, what suggestions do you have for organizations to create a healthy psychological environment, especially in these tough economic times when people have to make really difficult choices?
Well, I think first and foremost, there has to be an openness to dialogue and discussion, and that managers, if we're thinking about them as the front line, as the interface with supervisees and workers, you know, really need to be prepared to a degree to listen to people's concerns, not to counsel, not to be, you know, in the position of therapist in the workplace, but in a very human way to listen to what people are concerned about and struggling with. I think that listening capability in itself creates a very different kind of environment than a situation in which managers are simply viewed as workers in a higher position who are simply looking at the productivity of an individual but take very little interest in them as human beings or, you know, as individuals who have more complicated responses to the work environment.
Mm-hmm. Right. I do think that is important, and I do think that that's also, you know, my observation and my experience is that the listening piece of it is one that really managers are not supported in doing. And what I mean by that is that often it's not part of their training. So I think I'm glad that you mentioned that because I agree that that's really important. And I think it also is important. We can't just expect managers to be made managers and automatically know how to do it. They need to have the support from the organization.
Right, and there's of course there are psychologists who elect and have specific training in working with an industrial or corporate setting,
mm-hmm.
and their skill sets are particularly well suited to working within those business settings and helping managers and you know, management teams deal with the psychological climate and deal with individuals within the organization who, you know, may need specific forms of management or may need more attention for them to achieve productive lives within the organization.
Mm-hmm. Now, what would you say? You already suggested that individuals take an inventory of their internal talk and what they're saying, kind of take a look at that. Do you have other suggestions for individuals, no matter what the level, And again, given, you know, fears, anxieties, concerns, especially over either choosing priorities, over making tough decisions, or having to implement them, given that there are fewer resources available, what are some of the things that individuals may do to really kind of protect their own psychological health here?
Well, I think there are a number of things. If we can move out of the sort of the corporate and business world, where we can extend this a little bit more into daily life.
Okay.
I think some of the things that people can do to ensure or to improve the chances of their goals being achieved are to write them down, to create goals that are well-defined and have specificity. Also, I think it's very important when one sets a goal to make it a goal that has personal meaning, because very often people will generate goals which seem at the moment to be significant, but they're not particularly inspirational or meaningful for the individual in the long run, and particularly for more complex goals like getting an advanced degree or going to medical school, for example. I think people really need to have some fire in their belly, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
or else the goal eventually will wither and be less interesting. I think it's also very important to have a way to partner up with certain kinds of goals, to have reinforcements that are available. For example, a very common situation for, I think for all of us, is the setting of physical goals when we feel we're getting out of shape or we need to, improve our overall health and condition. We often will get a gym membership or buy a piece of equipment that we then put in our garage or our home, but fairly quickly the motivation fades. So one of the very popular ways to implement that kind of physical goals is to buddy up with somebody, to find a friend or a partner, a spouse who is interested in moving forward with a similar goal, and to integrate them into the plan. I think in some way, shape, or form, that kind of partnering can be extremely important in the implementation of various kinds of goals, not just, physical development,
right?
As I'm suggesting.
Right. But I think you're right. I like that example, because not only is it one that probably most people can relate to, it also is easily extended to other areas. For example, in the workplace, if you think of your buddies as being people on your team, or even a coworker, and, there's something that you need to achieve, as you say, it will increase the possibility or the probability that you'll be able to achieve it or implement the goal, if there's someone who takes that journey with you.
Yes.
So I think
that's,
yeah.
I think that is very important. Another thought I have about this that probably isn't discussed as often, and I this is an area of interest for me, is the whole issue of, are we sort of uniquely qualified for this particular goal? Do we have the skill sets, or can we develop the skill sets that will aid us in implementing a particular goal? And I think it's important to think about that and examine it. And I think there's one of my pet peeves,
mm-hmm.
as a psychologist, particularly as a child psychologist. Unfortunately, I see in affluent communities a trend which I find very disturbing. And I don't want to sound cynical or in any way negative about people achieving their dream, but there is a trend which I think could be described as, you can do anything you want in this world, And many children are raised in our culture now, particularly in affluent communities, to believe that they are uniquely skilled to be top pro athletes, dancers, actors, actresses, Fortune 500 CEOs from the time they're 6 or 7, that they have the right stuff. And while I think it's important to inspire our children, I think we can inadvertently infuse them with almost a grandiose sense of their own power and ability. And going forward in life, that kind of message, when it's not grounded in reality, in the real abilities of an individual, can be incredibly damaging. I see so many young men and women in my practice who have grown up with every conceivable form of activity and tutoring and come to be 20 or 21 and discover that they are not going to be the pro soccer player that their parents thought they would be, or that they're not going to make it in Hollywood. And it can be a crushing blow, and it can interfere with an individual's ability to truly understand who they are as a person, mm-hmm. and what their real abilities are.
Right, and I think that's very important on, you know, for a number of reasons, one of which is that children who are brought up that way are now in and entering the workplace. And so, and they're entering and are in colleges and universities. And so they are moving into worlds in which people are not going to tell them these things, yet their expectations may be out of line with the expectations of those that, you know, they're working with or are working for. And so I think that's an important point. I also think in terms of implementing priorities, if people are led to believe that they do have, as you say, a unique skill set, then when they come up against something that they can't do, it seems to me that they might be more likely to blame themselves as some internal fault, as opposed to saying, well, wait a minute, why should I be able to do that? You know, why should I be able to, you know, do a slam dunk when I'm, you know, 4 feet tall?
Exactly right. And that's really what I'm talking about. And I think that is absolutely a potential issue for individuals to begin to blame themselves. But another scenario is that they may blame the world because they've been led to believe that they are unique and they are endowed with unlimited talent. And so moving out into the world, whether the world is the university or the workforce, when they come in contact with managers and supervisors who don't appreciate them mm-hmm. in the grand way that their parents did and do, I think it can be extremely frustrating. And that frustration can lead to conflicts, anger, motivational problems, disharmony.
Mm-hmm. Right. And that's particularly harmful when, you know, there are priorities that need to be achieved and, you know, people aren't able to do it and they don't understand why.
Yes. And in a more systemic way, I suppose, one could say that at least in certain segments of the culture, children are not being trained to set goals. Things are being done for them. I'm always stunned by although I shouldn't be, how little we expect of our children. When I'm working with a family, invariably, when I begin to talk with parents about their expectations for their child, the expectations are usually limited to school or maybe athletics, but there is very little expectation in terms of being a team player within the family. Kids very seldom are assigned chores and tasks any longer. And even though this may sound a little simplistic, I think that team membership and the participation in family goals of one kind or another, whether it's picking out the trash or setting the table, I think these are the fundamental building blocks of goal setting later in life.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I think that this is very often absent in modern life for a variety of reasons. Many of the things that children in years gone by have done for their families are now being done by helpers of one kind or another, you know, live-in help or people who come to the home, housekeepers. A lot of these functions are no longer being performed within the family.
Right, they've been outsourced.
Yes, they've been outsourced, right.
Okay. Well, let me... is there anything else that you would like to add before we end here?
No, I think that I have pretty much covered the areas that I, you know, consider to be significant in terms of goal setting. I suppose there is one thing that I would like to say, and that is, people talk about hitting the wall in the literature and in life, and I think it's a particularly popular phrase for high-level athletes, you know, runners and such, that place that you get to when you're exerting yourself, where you just don't think you can go on.
Mm-hmm.
I think this concept has significance in the world of setting priorities and goals also, because, again, people do hit walls when they're trying to achieve goals, whether it's an educational goal or whether it's, you know, one of my patients who's working for a gaming company, and they're trying to get out their, you know, their beta program for a new game, and they hit some kind of a glitch or a problem. And these moments, whether it's athletic or technical, have to be tolerated, and people have to have the ability to recognize that it is simply a moment in time and that it is part of achieving a goal. There will always be some kind of a wall that one hits, particularly with long-term goals. And I think people are often not prepared for that. And so they can become frustrated or deflated when they hit whatever that wall is for that particular goal that they're moving toward.
Mm-hmm. Talk about saving the best for last. I think that's really a critical point. The fact that, despite your best planning, and in the interviews we've heard with particularly first responders, they say no matter how much and how well we prepare, there always are things that come up that we don't expect and often that we've never seen before. But the difference between the first responders and the scenario that you just described, I think, is that they do expect that something will happen, whereas I think you're exactly right. The majority of people in our everyday lives don't expect. And so when the unexpected does happen, we're surprised. And I think that's a great point, that we really do need to be prepared for it. And secondly, I think also very important, is that it's okay. It's in the grand scheme of things, it's going to be okay.
Yes, and in fact, I would like to suggest, and I try to do this in my counseling and therapy with people, I like to build in the notion of challenge and sort of creative engagement, so that when people hit the wall, instead of seeing it as a frustrating moment in time, they actually view it as a challenge, as something rather exciting that they can try to sink their teeth into and outwit, if you will.
Mm-hmm. I like that, and I think it's particularly appropriate in these days to look at whatever environment you find yourself in and view it as an opportunity and as a challenge. This is, I get to see, what I can come up with. I think that's great. Well, thank you so much, Michael, for sharing your expertise with us.
You're welcome. It was nice chatting with you and fun to talk about these things.
Well, great. We've been talking with Dr. Michael Seskin, a clinical psychologist in practice in San Diego, California. To all of you listening, thank you for being with us. And I'm Pat Lynch. Have a great day.
We hope you enjoyed this edition of Deft Decisions in Chaotic Conditions, How Experts Create Order from Turmoil, brought to you by Business Alignment Strategies. If you would like to learn how you can ensure that your organization's people, programs, and processes are aligned with its goals, contact us at www.businessalignmentstrategies.com.